Merry Christmas, everybody, and welcome to this end-of-year special episode of Media Voices, bringing you all the news and the views from the previous year. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
This time we're going to be doing a sort of whistle-stop tour through all the major media events of the past 12 months. Ahead of that, though, we want to trail some exciting things that are coming in the near future.
We have our very own Publisher Podcast Awards coming up on March the 4th of 2020, which will be here in a few weeks.
That's terrifying.
That's 2020, not the Podcast Awards. we're getting all the award entries over to the judges now, and I think it's safe to say we've been pretty stunned by the quality of them. Like, I do not envy the job that those judges have.
Gotta be honest, I'm absolutely blown away by the organisations and the podcasts that have entered. It's mental.
Some of the names in there are insane. Like, it feels like validation of this idea that that publisher podcasts are going to be a huge thing next year.
Yeah. We will be releasing a shortlist in January, so once we've done that, we can then share with everybody else some of the amazing names that have entered. Until then, though, if you are a company that's interested in sponsoring, please do get in touch with us, because we're now looking for our first sponsors for this.
Give us your money.
And I will say at this point as well, a big thank you to Pod News, who are our media partners for this event. They do a really great daily newsletter all about podcasting.
Thank you, Pod News.
Pod News.
But that's not the only major event that Media Voices and the Media Voices team are going to be involved in next year. Peter, why don't you maybe announce something to our audience?
I would like to announce we're going to be at DIS in Berlin, and we're going to be doing a live podcast recording from a stage in Berlin at DIS. We are so excited. It's on the 25th of March. I think the early bird's still on for that, so get your tickets, come and see us and see all the other cool people that are going to be at DIS. Did I mention we're going to be at DIS?
But having looked forward, it's time now to look back at the previous year. And using our Media Moments 2019 report, which you can download by going to What's New in Publishing, we're going to be taking a sort of whistle-stop look at everything that happened this year over a bunch of topics, including M&A, trust, platforms, all the major issues that media has faced this year. And when I was putting the report together, I was struck by how many people at the end of 2018 thought that the M&A, you know, silly season was over, that we'd seen all the big media M&A kind of come and go in 2018. I know. And that just kind of hasn't been the case. I think part of it was that people thought, well, we've seen these huge deals. Realistically now, people are going to get their houses in order before they start, you know, going on the hunt again. But that hasn't been the case. This year alone, we've seen, you know, Vox taking over New York Media, The Vice, Refinery29 acquisition, you know, DMGT acquiring The Eye.
I was going to say, even in the last few weeks of this year, we've had, like, to keep up with all the M&A and the news roundup. It's been quite challenging.
Exhausted by M&A chat.
Pretty much.
So I guess, like, is this, have we seen most of it now? Or is next year going to see the same thing?
We quote it in the report, and Ken Doctor noted, he actually said that at the beginning of the year, consolidation and the cost cutting that comes with it remains the dominant strategy in the daily newspaper industry. So if revenue continues to drop at or even near double digit levels, the consensus thinking is that radically reducing expenses through consolidation is about as good a card as anyone has to play. Do either of you think that we have seen newspaper revenue bottom out?
Nope.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Some newspapers maybe, like the likes of The Guardian doing what it's doing with reader revenues, and The Times, and maybe the Financial Times is doing great. So yeah, maybe in places, but local press, Jesus Christ, it's taking a kick in.
JPI Media, and in the US as well, we have, you know, kind of everyone's talking about Alden and their sort of relatively evil habit of just like buying up newspaper groups and stripping out all the costs. And they're still on the hunt for this because it is a viable business strategy for them. In terms of, you know, magazines as well, we've seen, what was it, Future?
Yeah, Future and TI.
Yeah, I mean, that was only, when was that? Only a couple of months ago.
Yeah, not even.
I think we're going to, and I know we've talked about this a bit in various news roundups when it's cropped up, but it's the big organizations are going to be fine. You know, the huge ones, the Washington Post, the New York Times, all of that, they're going to be fine next year. And at the other end of the spectrum, the tiny ones who've got these really niche, you know, reader revenue strategies, I'm sure Peter's got more on that, they'll also be fine. It's those ones in the middle that kind of can't really, that their costs are too high to cut down much. And, you know, they've maybe not got their diversification strategies in place, that they're the ones that are going to end up being like sucked into the big organizations that are just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I think the interesting part about this, though, is the actual merger, the deal, is only the starting point of these things. It's how you then go on and actually integrate two organizations, two management structures, two sets of staff, two basically publishing ethoses.
Yeah.
That's a word.
I mean, like Vice and Refinery 29 are going to struggle there because they're so different.
Yeah. I mean, editorially, they are so different. In terms of audience, they are so different. So the Vice Refinery 29 merger was effectively done because Vice wanted their experiential capability.
And their female-focused audience.
Yeah, exactly, their female-focused audience. Meanwhile, I think we mentioned in the report that Vox and New York Media have their editorial strategy is actually kind of very aligned. So they're going to find it much less hard to integrate than, you know, the Vice or...
Although there were concerns among the staff there that maybe there was too much overlap, so you'd end up with some of the things they cover basically being cut.
Yeah.
I think the thing with the Vox New York Media one is that while there is overlap in terms of what they actually cover, they cover it in very different ways. And they have very different audiences for it. I think that, you know, while the topics overlap, the audiences don't necessarily do that.
But is it all about consolidation and right sizing?
Not necessarily. We've seen a couple that I think are almost to get ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. Right. So if you look at what's happening with... So, I mean, the DMGT acquiring the Eye, that's still in service of scale, but it's also a you know, kind of bet on the fact that the Eye is successful in its own right. This is a growth play, not a consolidation play.
Right.
But if acquisitions and mergers were the priority for, say, the management side or the owner side, in terms of editorial strategy, getting reader revenue up to a sustainable level has been one of the real focuses of 2019.
I guess it's just been picking up speed through the year. The one of the quotes of the year for me is, the pivot is real. So that was Chartbeat CEO John Saroff. And, you know, the evidence for that's all over the place. You look at any newsletter, any report, anything that comes out, any media analysis, and it's people talking about how they can get money direct from the readers. And it's so obvious that Tau report that came out a couple of weeks ago just kind of nailed it. The idea that the platform era is over, there was never any revenue, there's no trust in the platforms to do anything that will support revenue, so people have had to go out and figure out their own reader revenue strategies. And that's to counter digital advertising disappointments that have never, you know, there's never really been the value in digital advertising that people hoped it would be. Print obviously slipping away. So they've got to reestablish these reader relationships and make some money themselves. I mean, I think what's interesting this year, maybe more than 2018, was the idea that quality of content is really, really come to the fore.
Yeah, you know, and less content in a lot of cases.
Yeah, the idea that less is more for some people. I think the Atlantic's introduction of the paywall, delayed introduction of the paywall, was interesting because they did stop and invest in more people, better tech, better content, basically. And it seemed to have an impact in terms of pre-paywall traffic. So it'd be interesting to see how that one goes, but the fact that people, or certainly Atlantic in that instance, aren't just throwing these paywalls up and saying, okay, that's us sorted, I think it's a really big deal, because there's no, you know, we say it all the time, there's no silver bullet here.
Can I ask the really annoying question that I feel like everybody's asked at every single conference this year?
Is it subscription fatigue?
It's subscription fatigue.
Well, yeah, I think it's... I'm not sure that we're there yet, but I think it's real. It's a very, very real prospect.
Yeah. So if you think about what happened with the LA Times earlier this year,
yeah.
Do you remember they failed to hit their reader revenue targets?
By
not quite, because they weren't signing
a bit,
people
wasn't
up.
It was a huge number they missed it by.
It was, but it was less about not signing people up and more about not retaining people.
Yeah, that's the retention strategy is massive.
Yeah, and I think that when we talk about subscription fatigue, one of, you know, friends of the podcast, Thomas Bechdel, has basically pointed out that newspapers not need to start thinking more like fashion designers. He says that nobody has denim fatigue. It just means that, you know, people are more aware that they're in. Yeah. He's basically saying that there is endless amounts of, you know, jeans and denim related products out there. But we don't talk about denim fatigue because people don't think about it in the same way, and that news consumers are effectively now, you know, thinking of news in a different way, whereas publishers are still thinking about them in the same way.
There was a really interesting article out in What's New in Publishing last week about Gazeta Y Boxa, and how, so they were basically talking about their discounting strategy, and they've managed to grow their subscribers from like 170,000 to 200,000 like in just 9 months. And they were saying actually that they used to do these discounts, these end of year discounts that would get these readers in for a year, and then they just end up being abandoned. But they were like, you know, that discounting subscriptions isn't a long-term strategy because people just drop off after a year. They don't really engage with the brand if they've just picked up a subscription for cheaps. So instead, they're putting all their efforts into strategies to keep people on the site, and retention and things like auto-renewal, and just making sure that people stay in that ecosystem past the year point.
Yeah. Yep.
No, you've got it. You can make loads of promises. You know, take this discounted offer and we'll give you this and that and the other. And if you don't deliver on those promises, you're done. No one's going to renew. They're not going to upgrade to a full price subscription. So you can market the absolute shit out of it. And if you don't deliver on it, you won't get anything.
Yeah, I mean, like, more people are subscribing to stuff, but there's a lot more stuff to subscribe to. So that's a bit of a bit of a loop. I think it's that thing, that, and I know, Peter, you touched on this a bit in the chapter in the report, is that it's not just a case of shoving up a paywall. Like, there are so many different ways to get reader revenue, even if that's things like events and, you know, getting paid tickets for an event. That is a reader revenue stream. It doesn't have to be put up a paywall and get this huge attrition. There's lots of different quite clever ways that publishers are looking at to get reader revenue and to avoid this whole, I'm paying for like 10, 9.99 things a month.
Yeah,
it's also that idea that it doesn't need to just be your core offering. So the New York Times obviously is the poster child for this, in terms of the cookbook and the, what do you call it?
Crossword
puzzles. Yeah,
parenting.
People that can come out with those sorts of extensions. The point of reader revenue is to take money from the readers. It doesn't mean just sell them stuff to read.
Yeah.
And I think it's that relationship that's really, really key to this. And technology's playing a big part in that. You know, people doing
propensity modelling.
Propensity, yeah. So they know what kind of products, what kind of content to send people that's going to get them engaged and get them to renew.
I think the Times have done some cool stuff with that.
Well, Times has had some good results this year as well. They reach over 300,000 digital-only subscribers. That number still looks relatively small to me, though, considering that...
Yeah, but we're so used to the US numbers, and that's always going to be a bigger market.
Yeah, it's like, what, NYT 3.5 digital-only? It seems crazy.
I also think we should... I know we're not right at the beginning of this. The New York Times and the Times, whatever, have been doing this for a decade. But for a lot of people, we're right at the beginning of reader revenue paywall type technology. And I think there'll be a lot of developments in this over the next couple of years. You know, the new European change is interesting. You know, where they had that micropayments model and then they've shifted to the donation type model. I think that's pretty ballsy, the fact that they said, well, you know what, we tried this, it's not ideal, so we're going to move to something else. I think people are going to be doing that a lot more.
Yeah, I think that works as well, because it was what Guardian basically said. They had, 300,000 one-off contributions. They're effectively a mission-led publisher as well. And Digital News Report found that, 7% of people pay regularly, but a further 2% of people will give one-off contributions. Yeah. So there's a lot of headroom there.
Yeah, but so with the people always cite the Guardian when they're looking to these donation-style models, but... I did some calculations, actually, because I was having this argument with somebody a while back. And it's like the Guardian reaches millions and millions and millions of people. So 300,000 one-off donations is great, but it's actually about 0.2% of their entire audience.
Mm.
So if you're a smaller publisher, you know, like the New European, perhaps, although they've got a passion-focused audience, it's slightly different. If you're looking at that and you're looking at a 0.2% conversion on your audience donating, that is going to be literally pocket money for some publishers. So it's the optional donations model is great for the Guardian, but I don't necessarily know whether that scales down in quite the same way.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess we'll find out next year.
Well, that's true.
I bet you it converts at more than those percentages, just because of the passion.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be interesting next year as well to see how, you know, JPI's local titles that are trialing paywalls do. Because, I mean, you don't have to be huge to make a success of a paywall. I was reading about the Shawnee Mission Post. It has 2,500 subscribers, but it only employs 3 people full time. So it's making a real go of reader revenue. It just doesn't have huge costs.
But that comes back to even that idea that an individual person can make money from readers.
Yeah.
You know, these newsletters, we've talked so much about Stratechery and the Synology one. Those guys make money. And it's just a one-man band. I'd say just a one-man band. It's a hell of a one-man band, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, I don't think it's about the size of the operation. It's about getting the product right. It's about creating content that people really, really, really want.
It's not about the size of the dog in the fight. It's about the size of the fight in the dog.
You slag!
So reader revenue, definitely one of the focuses of the year. But something that's kind of been bubbling under for a while, and something that actually underpins a lot more revenue strategies, is data and kind of what data is doing to empower advertising. And Esther, you wrote this section of the report.
Oh gosh, yeah. I actually had a similar problem to you in that, like, data was massive last year, and there's so many different strands to it that actually picking a strand to write, what was it, 1,200 words we had on this,
mm-hmm.
was really difficult. But I think for publishers, it's been the death of the third party cookie this year. I mean, yes, there's loads of other stuff around ad blocking and privacy regulations, but this idea that the third-party cookie will probably not be a thing in 2 or 3 years' time is massive for a lot of publishers. And I guess just a bit of context, because actually people never bother to explain this, but a third-party cookie is a cookie that's been placed on somebody's device by a site other than the one that they're on.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to Amazon.com and Amazon can put a cookie on your device, which, you know, that's fine because that's tracking shopping baskets and stuff. And you need first-party cookies. They're like essential to how the internet works. But then there's loads of ad networks that are also placing cookies on people's devices. And they're then the ones that follow you around the rest of the web being like, do you want a toaster? Do you want to buy this toaster? Do you want to buy this toaster? Do you want to buy this toaster? It's like, I bought the toaster. And so this whole idea of like the death of this third party cookie has been driven by, obviously there was last year, the privacy regulations, GDPR came in and said, yeah, you've got to be accountable for the data you hold on people. We've got stuff coming in the US with California's Consumer Privacy Act.
Oh, that's just going to muddy the water so
much. I know. It's just going to be so complicated. But the biggest thing that has driven it this year, which hasn't got a huge amount of attention, is actually browsers. So I don't know if either of you remember the Apple WWDC event that they basically said, oh, yeah, we're releasing a new tool that will block third-party ad trackers. And Firefox then in September also said, oh, yeah, our latest browser update is going to block all third-party cookies by default. Again, there's another kind of industry intake of breath there. Because actually between them, Firefox and Safari control about 40% of traffic to publishers.
Sure.
Well,
thank God it stopped there.
Nope. Mm-hmm. If you use Google, Google haven't committed formally to any of this yet, but they've actually been seen to be testing a third-party cookie block in their latest Chrome 78 build, which is expected to be released early next year. And Google control almost 70% of the browser market. So, yeah, for any publishers that are relying on programmatic ad revenue, you can say goodbye to 52% of your programmatic revenue next year if you are still reliant on third-party cookies.
Well, it's interesting you say if, because maybe third quarter of the year, I've seen a huge increase in the number of publishers who are making a push towards... Well, in fact, you explain this better than I could.
We've had a little bit of this because one of our conversations episodes had Permutive and Dennis Publishing talking about how they were moving away from third-party data. And so a lot of kind of more forward-thinking publishers... This started with GDPR, but again, it's been driven this year by the browser changes. They're saying, you know, we can't be reliant on third-party data anymore. It needs to be first-party. So I think there have been quite a few that have done registration walls. You know, even the New York Times has gone quite heavy into registration walls.
I was going to say, what does that actually mean? What do they have to do to get first-party data?
It's about not being reliant on these ad networks. So if advertisers come to you and say, you know, we want to reach these audiences, you're not saying, oh, we've got a network that can do that for you, and you kind of publishers are not the intermediary anymore.
Does that mean a publisher needs to have their own ad tech?
Oh, yeah, but they all do anyway. This is stuff they've been doing since the start of the internet.
Serve their ads against their own data, basically. That's
Yeah. So their data management platforms need to be supporting that first-party data, not third-party. And so if an advertiser comes to you and says, I want to reach this particular audience, you can say, we own that. We've got that data. We can serve you that data. The thing is, it's obviously a lot smaller than third-party data, but that is better quality because, you know, and it's coming back to this kind of idea of context-driven advertising. If you're coming to a cycling site, you're probably interested in cycling, and advertisers don't need to make these wild guesses about you.
What about if you go on a cycling site and you're like, where's my toasters?
Yeah, that it's. I suppose it's been sort of this weird confluence of things where, you know, publishers have wanted to take back control of this for a while.
Oh my God, did you just say take back control?
And we've seen kind of the ad tech landscape get so ridiculously complicated and not transparent enough.
The biggest issue with first-party data is that you don't have the same scale you did before. So we've seen a lot of publishers come together with data alliances. So Ozone's the one that's really grown this year. And they basically pull all their data together. So they say, you know, we can suddenly bring all these segments together across lots of different audiences. So that's good. Collaboration is good.
So there's a direct link back to the reader revenue play here, because once you've got that reader relationship, if you're still serving advertising to people, you know, if they've registered ahead of paying money for the paywall, all these strategies tie together, right?
Yeah. So actually, registration walls is a really interesting example of that. So registration walls are like a really easy way of getting first party data. You can find out exactly who's on your site by getting them to fill in a box. And there was a report released earlier this year that said if publishers that have those registration walls are up to 40% better at driving subscriptions, because as soon as you've got that email address, as soon as you know who that person is, you've got that relationship with them, and you can start building, you know, you can send them subscription offers or whatever else, or bringing them into your ecosystem more once you've got that data about them.
It's all about the relationship, kids.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this ties again in what we're talking about with platforms. You know, it's the end of the chase for scale and back to the chase to know somebody better.
Yeah.
But only if you trust them.
Well, there's a thing there, because you were talking about getting to know your audiences better, getting to know smaller numbers rather of audiences better. And this year saw a sea change in how people think about trust in the media. So over the course of the year, we saw, you know, trust fall pretty much across the board. So since 2015, trust in the media in the UK has fallen from 51% to 40%, which is pretty terrifying. And that actually has a commercial consideration as well, because that's partially potentially responsible for the sluggish growth in the proportion of people willing to pay for new subscriptions.
I have a question here.
Yeah.
Has falling trust in the media caused this turbulence in politics, or has the turbulence in politics caused people to lose trust in the media because it's become so polarized? Yeah.
It's the second. Okay. It's the second one. Because exactly what Chris has said, Trump as an example, but even, you know, Boris Johnson, Jeremy Corbyn, they're all having a go at their part of the press. Mm. You know, everyone hates Laura Kunzberg these days because she's biased and a conservative stooge and blah, blah, blah. But is she? Or is she just reporting stuff in a way that people can pick holes in?
Well, that's a different point, because there's this huge conversation now, at least on my Twitter feed, I don't know how widespread that is, about whether journalists wanting to be on social, do they think that that's a reflection of the brand for which they work, or do they think that's just them kind of using it as information gathering?
Absolutely.
But yeah, there's kind of this year has seen this fall in trust again. We've seen a couple of places really, you know, turn to slow journalism as a bit of an antidote to that. So Tortoise and Delayed Gratification are kind of reaping the benefits of people wanting a place they trust that isn't necessarily affiliated with kind of the, you know, the mainstream media.
Okay, so in that case, I've got a question leading on from that. That if this is particularly bad in the UK at the moment, and the US is just about to hit its particularly bad point with the 2020 election. If in the UK things settle down a little bit over the next few years, I don't know what conditions would enable that. But if things settle down, will trust grow again?
Well, because people trust the news outlets to which they subscribe. Yeah. So trust in their individual chosen newspaper has risen, but overall trust in the media has fallen, and that is bad for, you know, a rising tide floats all boats, and the opposite is true here. It's harming the kind of the power of the press as a whole when people don't trust, you know, the mainstream media.
And I don't want to put social media up here as being at fault, but this is all social media's fault.
Wow.
Because people, exactly what you said, people are sharing stuff that's crap, it's not true, it's being blamed on other people. There's just this overarching thing of, what can I actually believe anymore? Mm. And I think that just seeps into other areas that maybe you traditionally used to actually trust.
I mean, trusting the BBC's fallen.
Well, to be fair, having defended Laura Koonsberg, the BBC's done pretty stupid things recently.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm saying.
And you're right. They have done. They have not covered themselves with glory in this election cycle.
Can I flag something up that I thought was really interesting? When I was doing research for the report, you know, people have been saying that local and regional media is a lot more trusted. And it is. And people have kind of pointed to that relationship that they have with their audiences as kind of a model for the national press. But one particular report this year kind of put the fear of God into me, which says that people do trust regional and local media more, provided they do not try to engage with national level politics and issues, which surely...
I thought the point of the regional press was to engage with regional political issues, not national.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, how do we then get this disconnect back up? Because if there's trust in your local press, how does that translate back up then to trust in the wider media?
Mm. Answers on a postcard.
Solve that for me.
That's a weird one.
Peter, is print dead?
Not yet.
It's been a weird year for print, though.
It's like The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
No, I mean, print is still a thing. Of course, print's still a thing. I've been saying this for decades. I feel like maybe not decades, but I've certainly been saying it for a decade. Print is still a thing. It will still be a thing for a long time yet. The problem for print is no one's quite sure what that thing is. You know, if you want scale, forget it. ASOS, closed their magazine this year. They had at one point 700,000 circulation. At one point they had a circulation of 700,000, and they closed it because it was, I guess, because they saw it as a cost. And at the other end of the spectrum, Beer Advocate, an American beer magazine, closed because they couldn't support itself with they couldn't support a print operation with the numbers that it was selling.
Yeah.
We saw some launches this year.
Yeah, we did. But, you know, here's what bugs me about print people. Print people use a launch as an excuse or as a reason to say, print's not dead.
Mm.
Which, yeah, print's not dead, but we still sold 60% less magazines last year than we did in 2005. So, yeah, we did see some print launches. There was a brilliant print launches. DC Thompson's Platinum, brilliant.
Yeah.
Biggest launch in a decade, that was.
Spotted a niche, went for it. And I think that's the point. If you can find a niche and you've got the backing, you should go for it. Because print will get you cut through.
There was Chris's favourite launch as well, Paddy Power.
Paddy Power.
There you go. Well, that's the other side of this, is brand collaborations. You know, people actually going to brands and saying, we'll do a magazine for you or with you.
Well, that, I think, is because when people say print is dead, they're not talking about the quality, because the quality of printed magazines has almost never been higher. But they're talking about the purpose of it and what it actually means. And effectively, for reaching audiences at scale, it is dead.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you can't actually give someone a really, really good experience with print.
No, but it's just not serving to reach huge number of audiences anymore, which is functionally what print used to do.
Absolutely, and that's the problem. It's the business model that's failed, not the format.
Yeah, certainly.
And what's happening there is, okay, you mentioned delayed gratification earlier. That's a perfect example of a magazine with a niche and a purpose. I don't know what they're selling these days, but last I heard was 10,000 copies.
Mm.
And that sustains that operation. It's right-sized. Do 300,000 copies at NME on the street, you're screwed. But 10,000 copies of delayed gratification, amazing production values, incredible content, you've got a market. The future for print, at least in magazines, we'll talk about newspapers in a minute, is going to be less frequent, more niche, lower volume, highly produced, increasingly collectible, branded, and more than likely independent and not part of a massive media organisation.
So good but different.
I think so. Good but different, yeah. Newspapers, Jesus. I think it's a very different conversation. This is what I mean about print. You know, print doesn't know what it is. A print newspaper is an anachronism.
Yeah. No, it is. And it's particularly when you look at things like I mean, Jesus Christ, if you look at the results from the Evening Standard.
So the Guardian's a great example. I spend money on the Guardian, but not in print, because why would I? I've already read anything that's in the paper on my phone. So newspapers and regional newspapers and local newspapers, the Cairn Cross Review, which we talked about in the report, doesn't really mention print.
Mm.
Well, it talks about figuring a sustainable model for regional and local news, but it doesn't frame that in a print context.
Print isn't part of that future then?
Not necessarily. I'm sure there are a couple of titles that can make it work, given where they are, but for how long?
You guys know me. You know I love print. My office is full of print. I buy print all the time.
Yeah,
I buy magazines.
Not
exactly. Moving on.
I mean, but things do turn around quite rapidly in terms of formats and mediums. When I was writing about the multimedia section, I was kind of amazed to go back to January and see how many people were kind of pulling out a video and quite so rapidly. This was after kind of the inflated video metrics scandal, but before we knew all the details, we just knew that kind of people had been gulled into investing in video teams. And everyone was basically gutting those teams that they'd set up at the start of the year. But over the course of the year, I'd be interested to see if you two agree with this. We've seen more people dipping their toes back into multimedia.
I would say there's a number of publishers we've spoken to on the podcast that have basically said that they're doing video, but they're doing it kind of a lot more thoughtfully rather than just like hiring loads of people, chucking loads of video out. It's like, how can we actually do this in a sustainable way before going into it?
The pivot to video was, other than the pivot to platforms, was the stupidest thing publishers ever did. And actually, it was probably stupider because it was more expensive. It cost people a fortune. People lost their jobs because of it.
Yeah. Oh, no, loads of people did.
So the fact that they're doing it more thoughtfully, intentionally, is absolutely a good thing.
But then a lot of that caution is dripping over into podcasting, which you can get up and out a lot quicker. So I've heard people be like, oh, well, we don't want to be, you know, we got burned by the pivot to video. We don't want to be burned by the pivot to podcast. And it's like, that is actually a different scenario. Yeah.
Do you know who people should be looking at for a case study on that one? Is DC Thompson, with Chris Finn's work at DC Thompson. Mm-hmm. Holy crap, that guy puts a new podcast out every 15 minutes. It's nuts.
Because I've seen everybody from kind of small marketing agencies up to the large publishers launch their own podcasts, and it's just not going to work for everybody.
No.
It might work as a bit of a content marketing play, but the kind of the big podcasts that we're talking about aren't the ones that kind of can be produced in-house by this small marketing agency.
No, I saw The Daily, which is obviously the, again, NYT's poster child for daily podcasting.
Yeah.
I can't remember the numbers because I'm crap at remembering numbers, but say it started with a staff of 4 now has a staff of like 24.
I think it's 18, but it's still like ridiculous.
It's just, you know, you don't, you can't do a daily news podcast with two people and an office dog.
A lot of that is about the fact that people are being a lot more thoughtful about who they're trying to reach with these products. So The Daily is the NYT's effort to get more young people invested in the NYT. When we had Meg Cramer, who's, you know, producer of Trump Inc. on earlier in the year, that was because they'd seen this opportunity to launch something and reach this audience that wasn't really being served news about potential impeachments and et cetera in a way that was suited to them. And in fact, you know, one of the things I spoke about with Nick Newman last week is this idea that you can use podcasting as a bit of like an entrance to the funnel for the relationship with an existing news brand, because young people want to consume it that way.
And I think there's, so I was having a chat to Claire Sanderson, who's the editor-in-chief of Women's Health in the UK. And she was saying actually that a lot of people have said to them, why don't you have a podcast? You know, where their audience is quite young, quite into health and fitness. They're in the gym. They're often listening to stuff. Mm. And they were saying to the publisher, you know, we like reading your stuff, but there's no audio. Like, where are you in podcasting? So they actually started with a sponsored podcast series, which was just like a they did like 3 minutes a day, 3 to 4 minutes a day. And it was like a 30-day body positivity thing. And because that went so well, they're actually now launching their own podcast in January. So there are ways to test the waters with your audience without, like, you know, hiring 20 people and going all out in it. And if it doesn't work, fine.
But what's interesting about that is the focus on the audience. Mm. Because what happened before with video was the focus was on the platform.
Yeah, absolutely.
People were trying to keep Facebook happy. They weren't trying to keep their audience happy. Now what's going on with audio, I think, is that they're looking specifically, just the example you've given is perfect. They're looking at the audience and thinking, how can we use this medium to serve them? I have to say, though, working on the Media Voices podcast is a bit like publishing top trumps.
What do you mean?
You too. Oh, when I was talking to Claire Sanderson at Women's Health. Oh, when I was talking to blah, 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 blah.
I did restrain myself. I talked to Nick Thompson earlier in the year. I did hold that
here
back.
Here we go. Yeah, well, I interviewed Larry Hackett, who was the editor of the biggest magazine in the world. So there you go. And I'm going to get him on the podcast next year. So there you go. I win.
All right. This time next year, I want us to look back and have produced a top trumps.
Top trumps. Publish a top trumps. Brilliant. That is brilliant. Oh, we could sell that. We could actually make some money from that. Freaking genius.
Esther, do you think you could design us some Top Trumps?
Yeah.
Probably, if you want the media, the Publisher Podcast Awards to run. No, I can't.
That'd be so cool. Have you got have been on the podcast to get on a card?
Yes.
Well, no, not if you pay us.
That's brilliant.
For every 100 quid you give us, we'll give you an extra star on one of your ratings.
Fucking brilliant.
Before we move on to platforms, though, I was disappointed this year that there's been little done with VR outside the entertainment world. There's been a lot of.
Can I dispute? Programs. I don't think that's disappointing. I think given what Peter's just said about listening to your audience, absolutely. That is entirely to be expected.
No, I know. It's just because I'm an easy mark for VR content. Mm-hmm. I want to walk through sewers with The Guardian again. I want to be in 16:9 again.
But... No one apart from you is sitting at home with a headset on, being like, I wish there was more VR content.
Yeah, I know. It'll just take a while before people start experimenting with it again. I think that's a shame because it is a fantastic medium. It's just not there yet. Anyway, platforms.
Yeah, I think actually compared to 2018, it's been a lot less turbulent. But I think if there was to be a theme, it would be that platforms have gone from basically sticking two fingers up to publishers to actually being like, oh yeah, we actually need you guys. Yeah. And yeah,
when I spoke to Madhav Chinappa, head of when I was talking to Madhav, he said that Google recognizes that effectively what 40% of their search results do lead to a news publisher, so they are reliant on them to some extent. Just maybe their priorities still aren't aligned.
Yeah, they just don't want to pay them for snippets, but okay, fine. So two big things that have launched this year is Facebook's News tab, which launched in October in the US as like a bit of a test run. I think you guys can remember we were discussing this in the news roundup that there were issues straight away at launch with the fact that they included Breitbart in their list of high quality publishers.
Oh, yeah. Nineties.
And they'd also managed to land themselves in some hot water with paying multi-million-dollar annual licensing fees for people like New York Times, Washington Post, BuzzFeed and some others. But if you're not in that 10% of publishers, they basically didn't pay anybody at all.
Can't do right for doing wrong.
So if there's going to be a prediction in 2020, that money will mysteriously dry up.
I mean, at what point do we just kind of say, yeah, carry the stuff, give us some revenue, but you're no longer one of our top five priorities?
Well, I think that's essentially what these guys have said. Facebook have gone to some of these organizations with the knowledge that the only way they will get them on board is... with
money,
bribes,
money,
are we
money,
allowed
money.
To call it bribery?
Yeah. No, it's just a carrier fee or whatever they call it, isn't it?
But there's absolutely no logic for it. Like, you can't pay some people to carry content and not others. So that will have to be reformed next year. It's bonkers. But I think there's still a lot of questions about whether people will actually go to a dedicated tab, because actually when they tested it back in 2018, the answer was an absolutely resounding no.
Yeah, can't have it in the news feed, can't have it in a separate tab. What do you do? Do you force people to wade through news as a bit of a pop-up when they launch Facebook or what?
That's Facebook. And they've been involved in a ton of other controversies to do with platform and data stuff. But, I mean, again, we could spend weeks talking about that.
The death of Western democracy wrapped up in platform and data stuff.
Anyway, before we get carried away with that, and I'm actually only going to briefly mention Apple News because we talked about it quite a bit in the news roundup last week with their newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Apple News Plus launched in March and I think in the UK in September. It's pretty much plateaued already. So Apple are now eyeing up a content bundle with News Plus, TV Plus, and music, which will mean even less money for the publishers in it.
Interesting how so much of what the platforms have done this last year has been,
you know, rubbish.
Excused. Yeah, but predicated on the idea that it's been good for the users. You know, to what extent are these platforms basically using the user as a scapegoat now?
Yeah.
Also, is it not partly because they've been the whole big tech backlash is presenting them as not giving a shit about anyone? So what they're doing is now saying, well, we give a shit about the users.
Yeah, but they don't.
So it's a smokescreen.
I mean, they do to the extent that the user is the kind of the product. You know, it's like every so often Zuckerberg will go out and he'll like pick a user off the factory line and go, yeah, that one seems good, and chuck it back on.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting whether they get broken up next year. Well, no, because I mean, this is the presidential election next year in the US will determine what happens to Facebook in the future.
I just think if people are constantly comparing you to The Matrix and to Skynet,
yeah,
possibly you've put a foot wrong somewhere.
And I will also just give a quick mention for the Google European Copyright Directive and Publishers row,
Melt,
which is still ongoing. And again, how that shakes out will probably influence quite a bit next year in whether anybody can force Google to pay a link for taxes fees.
Google's got to decide that they want to do that. No one can force them to do it. Well, I remember when I was talking to Madhav, we had a beer together at the Media Voices 100th episode. Yeah, good times.
Yeah, that's pretty good, I guess.
Oh, yeah, we had a 100th episode this year. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How is that not included on our roundup?
How is that not included?
So we've touched upon it a lot as we've gone through every single topic we wrote about in the Media Moments 2019 report. But I included a opportunities for 2020 section in the report. And I just wondered, maybe rather than going through that, if I could ask the two of you whether you believe that at the end of next year, media, you know, whether that be newspapers, magazines, broadcasts, podcasters, will be in a better place financially in terms of relationships with audiences, basically everything, than they are now.
I think that will very much depend on individual publishers. Will the publishing industry be in a better place? No. Will individual publishers be in a better place than they are now? Absolutely yes. Will some be in a worse place? Absolutely yes. So it's going to come down to individual strategies, individual markets, how they play certain niches, how they use technology, how they use the reader relationships. Do they expand into new things like events? Or it's going to be the trajectory that our industry has been on for the last 5 years is going to continue. Nothing dramatic is going to change.
It was literally almost exactly what I was going to say, just slightly less
with a Scottish accent.
No, I'd agree with that. I think the other thing is that it has been like quite a good year. Like, we've seen some really good examples of innovation in publishing, people actually making money, people getting back onto a sustainable track. I mean, if we remember The Guardian, the difference between 2 years ago and now has been amazing. Yeah. And yes, that'll differ across, you know, some publishers are absolutely screwed. But I think it's that thing that those that started laying the foundations 4 to 5 years ago are now reaping the rewards from that.
Yeah, those look at the future.
Yeah, those that didn't are struggling. So that gap is only going to continue to widen. And those that are doing well and have laid those foundations will do better. And those that haven't will continue to struggle. I think we're seeing quite a big growth in crowdfunding and entirely reader-funded models. You know, Tortoise is entirely reader-funded. There are a couple of others out there that are coming. And I think that's not billionaire-funded.
But to go back to your earlier point, when you take that to a local level, that's really difficult. Question of scale is just horrendous. You know, what's an interesting, but I guess I was going to say bellwether. I don't think it is a bellwether because I think there's some issues in the way they approach their business. But JPI, if someone can come in and buy that and do something positive with it, that would be great news because, you know, there'd be a lot of learning there. There'd be a lot of stuff that local press could actually learn from. Can Reach do stuff like what Reach is doing with the investment in the newsroom and the podcast, the news podcast that they're doing? you know, stuff that Alison Gow's working on.
Yeah, laudable.
Yeah,
it is actually very. you know, I think those kind of innovations might start helping us see something more positive in regional and local news, but oh, geez, it's a tough one.
So is our official Media Voices position cautiously optimistic?
For some.
Yeah. Depends who you are.
I'm excited for podcasts, though. Even the ones we've had in for the awards, like the innovation in there and what they're doing and the money they're making is amazing. And I can't wait to celebrate them in March.
And I'm excited for magazine publishing. You know, there's some really, really cool stuff going on with magazines.
And I'm excited for VR, even though it's not going to... So I suppose thank you to everybody who's listened to us over the course of the year. That is effectively the end of our wrap-up of 2019. Everything we've spoken about on today's episode is explored in more detail in the Media Moments 2019 report, which is available to download for free from our website, voices.media, or from whatsnewinpublishing.com.
And if you liked this episode, please share it with somebody else. This is clever maths here, theoretically, double our audience if all of you shared this with just one person, preferably who likes the media industry.
You can make it our Christmas present.
Yeah.
Sharing is caring.
And if you didn't like it, or did like it and have opinions, then please take our survey and tell us why. We've got links in our newsletter and on our Twitter feed at Media Voices Pod.
So that might be the end of Media Voices in audio for the year, but I suppose we are carrying on in
Gosh,
social.
You made me panic then. I was like, why is it the end of Media Voices?
Yeah. But we will be carrying this on our social channels for a little while. I think we might take a break over Christmas and New Year. But you can follow us on social by going to @MediaVoicesPod on Twitter.
So from Media Voices, we'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas. Other holidays are available. And a very Happy New Year. Or if you come from God's country, Happy Hogmanay. We'll see you in 2020. We'll see you very clearly in 2020. Oh, by the way, stop Brexit!
That's the loudest one yet.